From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
I'm Rose Arce, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. Last night, the president addressed the nation on immigration reform, and it is no doubt the topic of the day. We are joined today by Hector Tobar, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Los Angeles Times and the author of a best-selling book, Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. It is out in paperback this month from Riverhead Books, and I am pleased to welcome you to the show, Hector Tobar.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Hector, oh, what a night for those that are interested in immigration, huh?
Yeah, it's been the topic of the last couple of months, and, nothing less than national audience to see President Bush, to listen to President Bush make a major pronouncement.
Let's set the stage for our conversation today by taking a moment to listen to what the president had to say last night.
Once here, illegal immigrants live in the shadows of our society. Many use forged documents to get jobs, and that makes it difficult for employers to verify that the workers they hire are legal. Illegal immigration puts pressure on public schools and hospitals. It strains state and local budgets and brings crime to our communities. These are real problems. Yet we must remember that the vast majority of illegal immigrants are decent people who work hard, support their families, practice their faith, and lead responsible lives. They are a part of American life, but they are beyond the reach and protection of American law.
So, Hector, which ones of these immigrants are you writing about?
Well, I try to write about them all. You know, I have one of the early chapters in my book is about two brothers, one who is becoming an American citizen. Both brothers had crossed illegally from Mexico. And the first brother has made himself a legal resident and is about to get his citizenship, and that very same week, his other brother is released from jail and deported back to Mexico from the United States. And these two brothers, both from the same village, from the town of Ameca, Jalisco, had come, with their ambitions and had chosen two very different paths because they saw America as a country that offered opportunity, the opportunity to reinvent oneself, either as an entrepreneur, as a property owner, as the brother Jose, in my book, or as a person who could take advantage of the opportunity to steal, to get in bar fights, and to eventually get himself deported, like the other brother Pedro in my book.
The president last night was talking about two very, very different viewpoints as to who immigrants are. You've got this good brother, bad brother thing going in your book, and it seems almost like you're saying that both are true.
Well, I don't think I don't think you can any stereotype by itself is a complete picture of what a community is. You know, I think a community is made up of diverse individuals with diverse motives. That's just what it means to be human. And there's a lot of myth making that goes on around immigrant life. Especially in the last generation, when we've seen so many immigrants come to the United States. And my book is an attempt to shatter those myths, to sort of explore the lives of the real people who are changing this country.
Did you predict that your book was going to be released at a time when suddenly the immigration debate was going to come to the forefront in the way it has in the last month or so?
No, I didn't really anticipate that. I sort of felt like I was writing a Latino version of The Souls of Black Folk, you know, a book that would sort of be appreciated a little bit down the line in American history for having foreseen changes that were coming in the country. And so to have these massive demonstrations just a year after the publication of my book in hardcover and the very week that my book was coming out in paperback, it was a wonderful surprise, because it was a moment in which we saw the Latino community of the United States come to the forefront, entering American history with large crowds, with demands for a kind of citizenship. And to see that happen not just in the traditional places that are the centers of Latino community, such as Los Angeles or Dallas or Miami, but to also see it in places like Liberal Kansas. Liberal Kansas, a place that I described in my book, had just a few weeks ago the first ever immigrant rights march in its history.
But you've also had another phenomenon going out, right? You also have people speaking out against immigrants, accusing them of hijacking the American dream. This is a moment of intense debate. So while you're seeing a coming of age on the one hand, you're seeing a little bit of backlash on the other. Was that a surprise to you?
No, I think it's a common theme in American history for a century and a half. I mean, there was a mass wave of German and Irish immigration in the 19th century, there were voices that spoke out against it. There were people who were charging that the American culture was being changed, that America was being made into something that it shouldn't be. And that has been a standard response to every cultural, social transformation that's been brought about by immigration for 150 years. I think all the hue and cry, all the controversy, is just the sound of the United States becoming a new country. And that process is one that's been repeated throughout its history.
Did you feel any obligation to include more of that voice in your book as you traveled around the country and took a look at different types of Latino immigrants and different experiences? Did you feel at any point like you needed to have in the book an American who was not an immigrant from Latin America, who was feeling themselves, their livelihood, their culture threatened by the newcomers?
Well, definitely. I mean, those voices are scattered throughout my book. I remember encountering a man in Rupert, Idaho, at the local historical museum, who felt very, very threatened by the wave of Latinization that he saw in Rupert. I had gone there to write about the first ever Cinco de Mayo parade in the history of Rupert, Idaho, a very Mormon corner of that state. And those voices are to be found everywhere, definitely. I think even among the Latino community itself, there are sort of different shades of reaction. The overwhelming reaction is to feel a sense of sympathy to the new immigrant, to see in the story of the recently arrived the story of one's own family. However, there are many people who feel threatened, who have embraced cultural assimilation and don't understand why everybody else doesn't want to embrace it.
I'm Rose Arce here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. I am joined by Hector Tobar, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Los Angeles Times, and author of the best-selling book Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. Hector, you mentioned before Latinos who were also uncomfortable with Latino immigration. Let's talk a little bit about those people. Why are they so uncomfortable with people entering this country in the same way that perhaps their parents or grandparents did?
Well, I think that what has made them uncomfortable is the self-confidence of these newly arrived immigrants in their language and their culture. You know, I'm old enough to remember 1960s and 1970s Los Angeles, in which the ability to speak Spanish was a stigma. You know, it was something that you whispered your Spanish when you were in public, because you didn't want to be seen as someone who was just, a poor, wetback, to use a really common slur from those days.
Is that also a generational thing? Like you, I'm also a first-generation American, the daughter of immigrants from Latin America. Is there a sense among people from our generation a little bit that you want to move away from the folks who are new, and especially now that they're under fire?
Well, I think in our parents' generation, that was very, 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 a very strong a sentiment. It was a very strong belief But what's happened in our lifetimes is that we've seen that process of assimilation reverse itself. I mean, I'm a member of a generation that, you know, our Spanish tended to atrophy. You know, my father would insist I speak Spanish to him at home, but I didn't receive any education in the Spanish language until I got to college. So at the time I was, you know, 16, 17 years old, my Spanish was very poor. And then becoming a writer in a city, Los Angeles, that was so overwhelmingly Spanish-speaking, you know, you feel the need to sort of reach out back to your essence, you know, to where one came from. And for me, that was Guatemala. I went to Mexico to study also so that I could sort of learn about my Latin American identity. And I think many, many people of our generation have gone through that, process of reverse assimilation, because the pull of that Spanish-speaking culture, which is so much present around us, is so strong.
And what about this current debate? Is that going to make people want more to get in touch with their Latino roots? Is that going to mean that we're all going to want our children now to speak Spanish and hold on to this culture in defiance, perhaps, of folks who challenge whether or not Latinos are assimilating enough?
Right. No, I think that that's something that has defined the recent history of Latinos in the United States, is that whenever there is a threat, whenever there's a challenge to our presence in the United States, it does make our identity stronger. It makes us fall back on our culture, on our language, on our traditions, on the symbols of Latin American history as sort of a kind of self-defense. You saw it initially when the first marches, everyone brought out their flags, and you wouldn't just see Mexican flags. I mean, I even saw Uruguayan flags and Argentine flags, because, in fact, all of Latin America now, almost every country has a strong immigration to the United States.
But it seems almost as soon as they took out those flags, there was a little bit of talk out there of what does all this mean, and then people brought their flags back in, and suddenly we saw the American flag. So what happened there?
Well, I think that people... you know, it's the ambivalence that people feel towards the United States. I mean, I think that almost everyone who migrates to the United States has gone there because they embrace the idea of American individualism. They embrace the idea that the United States is a meritocracy, unlike the Latin American countries they're leaving. So there's something that is a very strong attraction to the United States. But at the same time, people feel a sense of rechazo, as we say in Spanish, of being rejected by the culture, of being menospreciado, of being belittled by American culture. And so that leads them to embrace their Latin American selves. And so this ambivalence expressed itself during the movement itself, because, you know, people came out with their flags, they came out with their symbols of Latin American identity, but at the same time they were afraid of sending the message to the American people that, you know, we're trying to bring Mexico, we're trying to bring Guatemala to the United States. No, that's not what the flag means.
I noticed last night that the president struck a very delicate tone when he talked about immigrants. You never once heard him say the words illegal alien. He was very careful to mention the contributions of immigrants, while at the same time talking about a buildup of National Guard troops on the border. Very, very delicate balance. What does that tell you about the state of the immigration debate right now?
I'm very, very surprised still at how much the Republican Party, there are segments of the Republican Party that are afraid to embrace that anti-immigrant rhetoric. Yes, there are many people who will use the word illegals as a noun, as we see in Fox News all the time, but there are many more people in the Republican Party who say, hey, these people are the future, you know, we can't alienate them. And that to me has been really surprising, to see the political establishment sort of recognize that the Latino population is, in many ways, the political future of the country in many regions of the country. That, to me, has been really surprising. And to see President Bush himself do that dance, that linguistic dance, is, to me, symptomatic, emblematic of the fact that you can't roll back what immigration has changed, the ways in which immigration has changed the United States. It's sort of a permanent feature now of the United States, that there is going to be a very, very large Latino presence, and people are sort of very gradually coming to accept that fact.
When we come back, we're going to talk about that future, and we'll take your calls here at 212-433-9692. Welcome back. I'm Rose Arce here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. I am joined by Hector Tobar, the author of Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. We'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can ask Hector about the speech tonight or last night. You can ask Hector about what's going to happen in the future after this speech and after his book. Hector, what did you hope to accomplish by writing what you wrote, and what kind of effect do you hope that it will have in the midst of this current debate?
Well, I first of all wanted to shatter the myth of immigrant passivity. You know, so much of the journalism that's done about the immigrant in the United States focuses on people as either, you know, victims, the noble savage, or as, you know, the gang members, the criminals. And I really wanted to show that the immigrant and the Latino United States that I knew was a country made up of people who were trying to create their own sense of community, who were actively involved in the civic project that is the United States, but doing it in their own way and often in their own language. That was the main purpose of my book, and to show how widespread this was, that it wasn't just an isolated phenomenon to South Florida or Southern California or New York City, that it was something that had penetrated into the heartland of the United States, and that in many ways Los Angeles was the sort of center and focal point of this transformation of the American identity, and that this culture that was created in Los Angeles, this multilingual culture of the city of Latino immigrants, is now exporting itself eastward across the continent, much as New York was the engine of a new kind of American identity as a result of the immigration of the 19th century.
Let's give the callers a chance to talk. I'm going to take a call now from Damien from Brooklyn. Damien, your question for Hector is?
Yeah, I guess I would say it like this. You talk about people participating in the United States, immigrants participating in the United States in their own language and sort of forefronting their own culture and sort of privileging it above integrating into the United States general culture as a whole. How do you really expect those of us who speak English, frankly, to deal with this? How do you expect us to not find this a threat?
Well, I think that I don't think that people privilege their Spanish ahead of English. No, I think that everyone who comes to this, who goes to the United States, sees English as the language of business, of government, of success. I think that that what's happening is that you just find more Spanish as the language of people's intimacy, of their family life. Yes, I think it is changing the United States, and it is a threat. But, you know, I mean, people said the same things about the Germans and the Italians. The Germans and the Italians changed what it means to be an American. I think that English is going to remain the language of the United States. I just think it's going to be an English that's going to have, you know, a lot more Spanish flavoring than it does now.
Hector, assimilation, obviously. This is Damien's question, I think, speaks to the heart of what a lot of people opposed to further immigration are saying. They're afraid that the United States is no longer going to be the United States they grew up with. Does history teach us any lessons about those sorts of fears?
Yes, it does. I mean, look at New York City in the 19th century. Look at the way New York City politics was transformed by Irish immigration. And yet, American democracy remained American democracy in New York City or in Chicago or any other city that was transformed by European immigration. I think that what we're going to see in the United States as a result of this mass wave of Latin immigration is a continued English-speaking republic, but at the same time, one who's with sort of the class struggle of Latin America. One in which you see more demonstrations, more distinctly Latin American forms of political activism, and those will be, you know, those will be expressed in English and in Spanish. You know, I think that what sort of, I also think that the immigration door is gradually going to become closed over time. Even here in Mexico, there are people who say the door cannot be remained open forever. And I think gradually there's going to be a tightening of controls on immigration. And it's been happening now for the last 15 years, from the construction of the walls in Tijuana and other metropolitan areas, now to the possible deployment of the National Guard.
Okay, and I want to thank Damian for his question. And let's take a call from Tony in Long Island. Tony, what do you have to say today?
Good afternoon. How are you? Thank
you. How are you?
For my call. I'm well, thank you. I was curious. We don't hear much from Latin American leaders of the immigrant population.
You're talking about leaders here in the United States,
yes,
not
yes,
like Vicente
States,
Fox, right?
There doesn't seem to be a Jesse Jackson or anyone of national stature with solutions to the problem. And I think that the solutions certainly have to come out of the community. That's the focus of the situation. What do you think, Hector?
No, there definitely is not a national Latino civil rights leadership. Part of that is because the community is so diverse, because, you know, the Cuban population of South Florida is a much different population from the mostly Mexican and Central American population of Los Angeles. And, you know, Texas has its own dynamic in terms of immigration with Mexico. So the diversity of the community has up to now sort of prevented the creation of a national leadership. Yeah, I think it's something that, you know, hopefully that'll be the next step in this process that we're seeing, by which the community is becoming more mature, more politically aware. I mean, we've seen now the first nationwide demonstrations of thousands and thousands of people who, you know, we assumed wanted to live in the so-called shadows and yet now have come out into the streets. But perhaps the next step will be the development of a Latino leadership. One of the things that is...
I sort of hope so, because there seems to be no one to speak to. It's very reminiscent of this Israeli-Palestinian situation. If you haven't got a partner on the other side and the community is so diverse, how are the people who are trying to solve the problem put together a solution? I mean, what would your solution be?
Yeah, thank you for that, Tony. Go ahead, Hector. What would your solution be? Thank you, Tony.
Well, I think that this is a problem that is also a Mexican problem. Living here in Mexico, I think I see now that immigration is more of a threat to Mexican national identity than it is to the United States of America and its cultural and national identity, because Mexico in many ways is becoming increasingly dependent on the money that people send from the north. It's becoming increasingly, it looks more and more like a colony of the United States when so many of its people have to migrate north in search of work and many times never return. So I think there has to be a Mexican solution to this problem that involves addressing the overwhelming poverty in this country, the breakdown of the education system. There's just so many social problems here in Mexico that have to be addressed. I think eventually there has to be some order brought to the border. I mean, I think it's...
That's interesting that perspective is the same from that side of the border as well. Let's take another call. This is Roberto from Manhattan. Roberto, what do you have to say?
I was listening to this gentleman. I think I'm very proud that he speaks four languages. But I think the problem that Mexico, that we have as a Mexican, we are not really assimilated into the society, and we are not really ashamed to be Mexicans. And also, I return to Mexico from Guadalajara as often as I can, even though that I was legal. The problem that I have is that the problem that we have now is going to always be like that until United States, I think, takes seriously the problem that Mexico has with the poverty. We don't come over here because we want to, because we really want to make ourselves a little better. That's the reason that we come. But I'm very proud of the gentleman that he writes in both languages, and he's a writer.
Roberto, do you want eventually to be an American culturally as well as an American citizen? Is that something that interests you?
Yes, I'd be very proud to be Mexican-American, because I think this country gave me so much, and I'm not ashamed to be Mexican-American. I would be very proud to be.
Hector, he sounds like some of the people in your book. Is that a point of view that's out there quite a bit?
Oh, definitely. I think, and especially now in these times of so much controversy, that idea that you might one day obtain that certificate from the United States that says you're an American citizen, is something that a lot of people really hold on to as their dream. You know, another thing that I really feel that needs to be a part of this debate is that the reason why so many people have difficulty assimilating now into American culture, into English language, English-speaking culture, is because the engine of assimilation is broken down in so many corners of the United States. Meaning, what I mean specifically is the education system. The public education system is simply not doing its job of providing education to, you know, tens upon thousands of young people who want to be whose families want them to be assimilated into the United States. And I think that's an important part of the equation.
And that certainly addresses Roberto's concern. Thank you so much,
right.
Roberto.
Thanks.
Tom from Brooklyn, you have some questions for Hector Tobar about his book.
Yes, I was wondering if you were aware of what city your grandparents or parents came from in Mexico. And to follow up on that, how would you feel if hundreds of thousands of aliens came to your town and changed the look, changed, took apartments, right. took jobs? How would right. you feel about that? Can you understand mm-hmm. that?
Well, my family's from Guatemala, and my father is from the banana-growing regions of Guatemala, Hualan, owned plantations owned by the United Fruit Company. And my mother is also from Guatemala City. I would say, in answer to your question, that yes, I mean, I can understand that people feel the country is changing before their very eyes. But at the same time, you know, the country is inviting people to come and work. It's saying, here are jobs for you to fill at these wages, and, you know, please come and fill them. And I would say also that the people who are coming to the United States are coming to become Americans. They are coming to embrace the American project and and everything that that means.
Hector, what makes you so certain of that? Because I know that, you know, people like Tom, they're coming from a perspective where they seem to sincerely doubt that that's true. You know, you hear a lot about this from folks saying, you know, people from Latin America are hijacking the American dream. What makes you so certain that that's not the case?
Because I have 20 years of experience of sitting down with people in their living rooms or in the workplaces, from Alabama to California to South Florida to Idaho, and all those, overwhelmingly, the people sound like my father. They sound like my father's a Guatemalan immigrant who came in the 1960s, who kept his Guatemalan identity, passed it down on to me, but at the same time, his proudest moment was when I learned the Gettysburg Address and I recited it in my fifth grade class at Grant Elementary School in Hollywood. You know, people have, I think people have a lot of trouble dealing with that ambiguity, that people can come here, they can look different, they can retain parts of their own culture, but at the same time embrace some of those central ideas. And I can't tell you that desire to become, to reinvent oneself in this country called the United States is something that is universal. You know, I would say among almost every immigrant I've ever interviewed.
I'm going to take a call now from Michael from Harlem, who wants to talk about Latino voting. I guess part of your question that you're asking is because you're wondering how all this debate is going to affect the next election. Is that right?
Yes. Hector, this is Michael Adams in Harlem, who you wrote about.
Hello. Hi, I'm fine.
A million years ago. Anyhow, because of what you said about the public schools, is there going to be any less disenchantment on the part of these new immigrants than there has been amongst African Americans? And will they vote any more in any greater numbers, or will they just bow out of the system the way so many other minorities who feel overwhelmed by circumstances and poverty and horrible schools?
I guess, Hector, that's a question that both political parties would just love to know the answer to, huh? So what is it?
Well, we have the experience of Prop 187 in California in the mid-1990s, which was a proposition that aimed to deny public services to illegal immigrants, from everything from hospitals to schools. And it passed. It was eventually overturned by the Supreme Court. But that proposition on the ballot led to a backlash among Latinos. It led to the largest increase in citizenship applications among Latinos in the history of the United States. And it changed California politics.
Now, in all fairness, you should also add that one of the reasons that proposition passed was that there was a significant number of Latinos who voted for it.
We're not so sure about that, actually. I think many did, but I think at the same time, it led to many people who had been living in the United States as legal residents to decide that they needed to become citizens. They needed to protect themselves that way. And I think that already we've seen a surge in citizenship applications across the country. These kind of moments tend to wake people up.
And then what happens to them now that they're awake? Because, you know, Prop 187 was some time ago. Are those newly awakened Latino voters becoming more active politically? How are they voting?
Oh, yes. The number of Latino elected officials in California has increased astronomically, as it has in many corners of the country. They tend to be sort of Democratic on social issues and Republican on cultural issues. You know, there's a strong Catholic presence, and so people tend to be anti-abortion, but at the same time, they tend to be more, you know, sort of progressive and vote with the Democrats on, you know, issues like, you know, school funding and taxation. So I think the verdict isn't quite out yet as to what exactly the future, is going to be in American politics as a result of Latino immigration.
Hector, when you're talking about the future, and I guess the political parties certainly would love to be able to predict the future. Is there any one thing that has happened in this last year that makes you look forward and say that we can count on Latinos doing X at the voting booth?
I think that it's just really too early to tell. I think there people are very angry. It's sort of awakened sympathy for the immigrant among people who already can vote, who already are citizens. In terms of long term, it's hard to say really what's going to happen.
Are there any raw feelings out there, do you think, in the community about this debate? I mean, we are, after all, debating human beings, and they're cast in some pretty negative light by some of their fellow residents of the United States. Do you think that there's going to be hard feelings on both sides, people that are saying, hey, you're giving a free break to these people that stole my job on the one hand, perhaps, and on the other hand, folks saying, why are you treating me like this? I just came to your country to work. You know, how do we heal from this?
Well, I think that there are definitely, I can say that among Latinos in the United States, there is a sense of having been insulted and wronged in so many ways of, every time I see Fox News and they use the word illegals as a noun, I find that deeply offensive. And it hurts me as a son of immigrants. Because yes, people have broken the law. They're illegal immigrants, but to call them illegals, that doesn't sit well with me. And I know it doesn't sit well with millions of people of Latino descent in the United States.
Hector Tobar, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Los Angeles Times. His book is Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. It's out on paperback this month from Riverhead Books. And I'm Rose Arce, filling in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.